Demonstrations and protests, some violent, others not, have dominated the headlines this week, and many involved in the actions say they're speaking up out of anger. Behind that frustration for many is racial inequality in our economy, housing, food access, even down to the layout of our cities. Today, we're speaking with reporters who cover these issues and experts who study them. I'm Randall White. Join us for those discussions just after the news. This is Cap Radio Special Coverage. I'm Randall White, and today's focus of conversation is the topic of racial inequality, which is taking center stage nationally and locally right now with the killing of George Floyd last week in Minneapolis and the wide-ranging demonstrations that have played out since then. In cities like Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto, Reno has seen demonstrations. Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero was at the demonstration in downtown Sacramento last night, and he joins us now. Ezra, what'd you see last night? Because you've been to more than one of these.
Yeah, I went Saturday, and it was an entirely different experience last night. On Saturday, you know, it started off peaceful, and then there's police, there were shots of rubber bullets, things like that. Last night was started off as a prayer meeting at Cesar Chavez Park in Plaza in downtown Sacramento, and it meandered through the city afterwards through a march, and it was rather peaceful. There were about 50 people that were arrested later in the evening because there was a curfew enacted at 8 p.m. For 8 p.m. a little bit earlier in the day. It was an interesting experience. I thought it was going to be a different feel altogether.
Yeah. Can you attribute anything to the shift in tone? Of course, a curfew was put in place and the National Guard came in, and that's what some people are saying resulted in this change. But did you witness anything else that might have also been behind that?
Yeah, I mean, the National Guard was there, so that was one thing. And there was a lot of officers, like two or three blocks out in every direction. So the crowd, when they saw those people, the officers and the National Guard, they, you know, the leaders tried to get them away from those areas. But then Stevante Clark sort of took over the march at one point. He's the brother of Stephon Clark, who was killed by police, Sacramento police, in 2018 when he was holding his cell phone. But they thought it was a gun. And he took it over, and he sort of like had this tactic, as I was calling it. It's like where he would have people take a knee, put their cell phone in the air, have moments of silence, have discussion points at different areas of the march. And it seemed to like calm the crowd a bit. And actually there's people that wanted to like break stuff and get on top of the tanks. And when they did that, like the crowd shamed them to get them off, and because they didn't want to see loss of life or people get hurt, from what I understand.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so there was really a voice, a leader at the front of this that had been lacking in days past?
I think so. I mean, it seemed like in the days past, it was a group. There were organizers for those other days, but it seemed like this time there was a person with a megaphone that people were following. And he was a familiar face in Sacramento. We've seen him on the news. You know, he was very prominent after his brother was killed. And, you know, we even on Cap Radio's airwaves, Stevante's been on there many, many times.
Yeah. Devin or Ezra, you and I cover, well, we've been journalists for a while, and we have a lot of friends, colleagues who we follow on Twitter. And I'm sure you've seen the pictures of some journalists throughout the country who have run into some bad circumstances at these protests and have been beaten up. And or have gotten in the way of rubber bullets or pepper spray or whatever the situation might be. What has it been like for you to be at these events?
You know, I've covered these events a lot in the past few years being at Cap Radio. It just seemed like that's what's these kind of, unfortunately, there's been shootings of unarmed Black men multiple times in this city. And so we've covered these sort of events. This time it was different just because it got violent. And there was a lot of breaking of windows and things like that. And so there was never really a moment where I was like scared for my life or anything like that. But there were moments where, you know, I saw friends I knew from in the city that were like bleeding profusely. And, you know, at one point on Saturday, I just had to walk away. You know, I'm like half a person of color. And so like something just resonated with me that day and just broke on Saturday. And, you know, I just had to walk away and gather myself. And then I actually went home And then last, and I just had to take Sunday to get myself back together again. Like, I just saw people of color, you know, just felt their pain. And, you know, it's like, I'm not a Black person, and I don't know what it feels like to be a Black person in America, but I'm a person of color. And so I can feel a little bit, and I'm also a journalist. And so we have this weird, just an interesting responsibility in that moment. And at some moments I just have to walk away and just stand far back and be, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know exactly what to say there.
Well, Ezra, when you approach a demonstration as a journalist, mm-hmm. how do you decide where to begin? There are hundreds of signs and a huge spectrum of people represented. For me, it can be daunting to capture the voices and opinions that truly represent that crowd. I feel it's a responsibility, of course, to do that as accurately as possible, though I know it is impossible to get it all into a 1-minute news piece or even a half hour show for that matter. What's your approach?
Well, I usually get there and I tweet what it looks like, what's happening first, just initially, like what's going down. And then so when it comes to this, when it comes to a march that's about race and it's about like racial issues for hundreds of years, I'm just mostly trying to talk to Black people and to hear what they're saying. And then often if you try to interview a white person or someone else, they may just say no and say, talk to the people this is about, because this is their story. And I think each person has their own unique experience, whether it's a mom or a sister or a brother or a young Black man or an old Black man or just a person there. I think it's their story to tell, even though a lot of people are affected by this and affected by police shootings, it's really their story. So when I went yesterday, I only tried to talk to Black people and what they are feeling and hearing and seeing and what is going on in their life. Even on my Twitter, that's only really what I wanted to have come across, is like, are there stories?
Right. Ezra David Romero, thank you for your work covering all of this stuff, all the work that you do here at Cap Radio. There's been a lot of conversation around equity and race relations in our city and in our newsroom recently. And next up, I want to bring in reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, who has been out at some of the demonstrations and has also been covering some issues around equity for Cap Radio. And Sarah, how have events unrelated to these demonstrations affected the way some people of color, especially Black people, feel right now?
Definitely. So I think it's obviously worth saying that this kind of the frustration that we're seeing bubbling up right now is frustration that comes from decades and decades of disenfranchisement and segregation. I think that can hopefully go without saying. I think more recently, we've seen through the coronavirus, a lot of tension coming up through just inequity and economic help. A lot of minority business owners, and we have covered this in the past, minority business owners who felt left out by a lot of the coronavirus aid that's been put in place recently, both federally and locally. We recently saw that just the city's Measure U funding, which was initially supposed to go towards underserved communities in our city, it's gone to fill the city's budget holes. And so it's not going towards what it said it was going to. And of course, the Stephon Clark shooting, which I think we can all remember from 2018, it really puts all of these things together. And I think many people in Sacramento have just felt somewhat forgotten about for a while. And so I think that's kind of where this places us emotionally.
Sarah, some of the reporting that you've done on the business side of things has focused on different business sectors. Can you explain or help paint a picture for why some minorities cluster in particular businesses?
Yeah. So I think like overarching all of this is, of course, a history of inequitable business loans. That's something that's been reported multiple times before me. And I think, you know, historically, African-Americans have received the smallest amount of loan money. And I think that you will then see that fallout, like people of color in general receive less in loan money than white people. And I think that's the reason why you see minorities clustering in certain businesses. It's a question of access. There are certain businesses that are just more accessible for people who may have a lower amount of startup capital, for example, or people who are going to have language barriers. There are also, just if you're thinking 50 years ago, just limited opportunities for people of color, especially, you know, when you're looking at your job prospects back then. If you're an African-American person, if you're an Asian-American person, what standing were you able to have in a white owned business world. I think honestly, the best chance that a lot of people thought that they could have is to start their own business. And then the way to do that is to go where it's easiest to start your own business, where there has been a legacy of minority business owners. So that tends to be things like nail salons, hair salons, barbershops for a lot of businesses in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, Ezra mentioned just a moment ago what it was like for him to cover the protests. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you as a person of color to be covering these.
Sure. So worth noting for people who don't know me, I'm Asian American. And, you know, I think oftentimes white people don't really know where to place us as Asian people. I think they don't know how much we may be feeling this. And I think a lot of white people maybe don't know how much racism Asian people feel. I think there's been a lot of history amongst Asian people of kind of a silencing. I know that like we're kind of thought of as a model minority, and that in itself is a part of a white supremacist system. I think, you know, I will say that if you're a person of color, you have experienced some amount of racism and some amount of the system that I think is being challenged right now. And so I think that these protests are going to be striking a chord within any person of color. Although obviously I'm not African American, and I can say race being a spectrum, that I don't think that I experience white supremacy in the same way that an African American person experiences it. But I do think that I experience it. I experience it. I think that's for sure. It's different, and it may not be as bad, or it may not manifest itself in ways that are as violent, but it's still there. You know, I think it's also worth addressing that Asian Americans have a very complicated history with the Black community. And it's all part of that larger system of white oppression that has already pitted Asian Americans against Black Americans, that maybe makes us feel like we don't have a place in this, or that we shouldn't have a say in this. And I think, I don't know, all these things are really important to consider. We're coming at the end of Asian Pacific Islander History Month. I think it's so important for other Asian people to know their history right now and know how their history of civil rights and of Asian rights in this country is intertwined and colored by African-American people's struggles with civil rights. I could probably go on like this forever, you know, you can tell right. I'm passionate about it, but well, I don't want
to. Certainly California has a history when it comes to the railroads, to in the city of San Francisco, limiting where Chinese people could live, which is now the, you know, famous Chinatown area. But certainly, yeah, the history goes way back. And Ezra, we still have a little more time left. I want to bring you back in to talk about some of your reporting regarding parks. This is a recent story you did, and how access to parks in the Sacramento region is not the same for everyone. And once again, it breaks down along racial lines.
Yeah, so the story, the Trust for Public Land, you know, they rank the top 100 cities annually and how well they're doing in terms of parks and open space. You know, California has some of the top cities on the list, but also some of the lowest. You know, Sacramento, so for example, in the bottom third are Bakersfield, Chula Vista, Santa Ana, Stockton, and Fresno. And in the top place, in like number six or seven, was Irvine. But they wanted, in that study, they looked at Stockton and Sacramento, you know, where they're not very far from each other. There's some farmland between the two necessarily, and the park scores are very different. You know, the authors found that in Sacramento that there's 83% of people live within a 10-minute walk from a park, which is above the national average of 72%. And for Stockton, that's about 74% or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not terribly different, but there is 10-12% between there, and we're not that far away from each other.
Right. And at a time when, you know, shelter in place was at its peak, getting out meant getting to a park if you could. And that wasn't necessarily easy for people at that time, for everyone, in the same way it might be if you live across the street from Land Park.
Yeah, Guillermo Rodriguez, he's the California State Director with the Trust for Public Land. You know, he put the Stockton-Sacramento divide a bit better than I just said it. So let's hear from him.
The challenge that what we've seen in terms of California is really an equity issue. For example, if you look at Sacramento, they were ranked at 30 this year compared to Stockton at 87. So for us in California, it's about equity. It's about thinking about disadvantaged communities and how to create access and opportunity.
All right. Well, Ezra David Romero, our environment reporter most of the time, but you have been out on the demonstrations. And Sarah Mises Tan, thank you both so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And just after the break, we're going to learn a bit about why current day Sacramento looks and feels the way it does and the policies that set up racial inequality. This is Cap Radio coverage. I'm Randall White. And this is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White. Today we're talking about racial inequality in the Sacramento region. And I posted a pretty simple question on Twitter earlier today asking, what have you seen that needs fixing? And Jamie Bick tweeted back saying, we need to confront and begin to correct the lingering effects of decades of segregation and redlining in Sacramento for a start. Well, last week, Cap Radio published and aired a piece I did on redlining and how new data collected in the Sacramento region shows those who live in areas that were redlined decades ago can experience temperatures 20 degrees warmer than more affluent neighborhoods on hot days, just like the one that we have today. I think 99 is the forecasted high. Vivek Shandas is a researcher with Portland State University who is an expert in how a region's design, like its streets, buildings, tree canopies, how it all comes together to create these climate inequities, which disproportionately affect communities of color in a negative way. It was Professor Shandas who was behind that heat mapping project I reported on, and he joins us now. It's great to see you. We are doing a Zoom chat here. Vivek, the data that you collected points to a pattern in Sacramento and really cities throughout the U.S., that show how you experience summer-like temperatures, including today, depends on where you live.
Right. Thank you, Randall. It's great to reconnect with you, and I'm really grateful for this chance to talk a little bit about this work. We've been at this for quite some time, trying to actually do this from the bottom up, meaning we actually engage with local community groups to be able to go out and collect these temperatures with little mobile sensors. And so we collect hundreds of thousands of sensors across a metro region. And the idea here is to draw very high resolution descriptions of what you and I and everybody would feel as we walked around these neighborhoods. And perhaps you walked from a parking lot of a big box store into a park that might be adjacent or into a shaded area, and you can actually feel those differences on your skin. And so that's really what we're after, is trying to get at, what is it that people, what is it that plants, what is it that buildings, how do all those things on in a city actually experience the temperatures that we are collecting?
And your data shows a direct connection to redlining.
Correct. So in our work, we've done a variety of different studies. One such study is actually looking at 108 cities across the U.S. and their relationship between how much redlining was happening and where that redlining was happening, and the difference in temperatures between those redlined areas versus those non-redlined areas. And across the 108 cities, we have found consistent patterns in 94% of the cities where the redlined areas were warmer and on average about 7 degrees warmer than their non-redlined counterparts.
And we'll be getting much more into redlining in just a moment, but just so that people understand, redlining was a process that was used to restrict where home loans could be given. And it was in these poorer neighborhoods of color that got redlined. And so you couldn't buy a home there with a loan.
Right. And you'll hear more about this in a minute, though I will just simply say that this home loans is a start, though it also went so far as education, as parks and open space, as the types of materials that are actually used in these neighborhoods. So from a heat experiential perspective, think about something you'd spend a lot of money on, clothing or food generally tends to be higher quality. And so when you're redlining an area, you're also directly using lower quality materials to design those neighborhoods. And often the kinds of materials nowadays that absorb a great deal of heat and re-radiate that heat back out into the ambient environment where people actually feel much hotter in those spaces. Yeah. So yes, it's a direct link between what you see on the landscape, often freeways, big box stores, really large either public or social housing projects. Lots of these kinds of things are going into historically redlined areas, a practice that was actually stopped in the mid-1960s, 1968, with a Fair Housing Act.
Yeah, where asphalt and concrete won out over the city's tree canopy, as I put it in the story. Professor Vivek Shandas, thank you so much for your data collection, which will be used by city leaders in some areas to help change decades of what happened. Back in February, just prior to the pandemic dominating the news, Sacramento Bee reporter Mike Finch had a piece published that was called "Legacy of Racist Redlining Lingers in Sacramento Neighborhoods, How This Costs the City." It's part of a new Sacramento Bee initiative called The Tipping Point. And Mike joins us now with more on what he learned through his reporting. Welcome, Mike.
Hi.
Yeah. Now, was
you have
this,
to go on, Randall.
Was this story assigned, or was it something that you pitched to the Bee editors?
This was something that I noticed. I monitor research a lot, and I'd previously written about tree disparities in Sacramento. And when I saw that there was a California-specific study that included Sacramento, I thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity to follow up on a story that I'd previously written on. And they came to very similar conclusions. The two studies.
Mm-hmm. And that was?
They both found significant relationships between the pattern or the previous pattern of segregation that's defined by these homeowners loan corporation maps, which are the essentially the redlining maps, and existing health outcomes today. So one study found that asthma-related emergency room visits increased as you move to a worse grade on the map. Mm. So like the poor areas that might've had more Black residents in them today see a higher level of asthma related emergency room visits than other places.
Mike, both you and I spoke with Dr. Jesus Hernandez, who's an expert on redlining in the Sacramento area, and I asked him to explain another aspect of racial inequality that helped define the city and surround suburbs called race covenants. They go hand in hand with redlining. He said starting during the Depression era of the 1930s, these federally backed loans called FHA loans became popular for housing. But Dr. Hernandez says there was a problem with that because these race covenants became a condition for getting the loans.
And so you would see places that had these race covenants take advantage of those loans, and builders as well as buyers were able to move very quickly in developing that space. So you saw Land Park, East Sacramento, Arden Park along the river, where you saw the extensive use of these covenants back during that time.
Yeah, and these are written right into the deed for many homes in the Sacramento area. So if you have an older home, you can probably find these race covenants right in there. One aspect of your story, Mike, is about what's next. How do we fix these decades-old problems that are baked into the entire layout of the city? You only have about 30 seconds, but can you sort of sum that up for us?
Basically, it's in existing policies today. When you notice that cities like Sacramento are developing an urban forest master plan, it's your opportunity to step in and say, you know, what about the areas that, you know, do not have as much tree canopy as some other places like Land Park or Curtis Park? That's your opportunity to step in and let city officials know that this is an inequity that you would like to see addressed.
Yeah. Sacramento Bee reporter Mike Finch. Check out his piece. We'll have it linked at capradio.org. Thank you. This has been Cap Radio special coverage. In about 5 minutes, we'll hear about new coronavirus testing in the Sacramento area. And even if you don't have symptoms, why you're encouraged to get it. Tomorrow morning on Insight, Beth Ruyak will explore the impact of the Blackout Tuesday social media campaign. Big thank you to Sally Schilling, Jen Picard, and Devin Yamanaka for getting this show on the air. I'm Randall White. We're back again tomorrow with you starting at 3:30.